Hello and welcome to a festive edition of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are jingling your bells with the brilliant assistance of oldfootballshirts.com. Well, last Saturday, Glenn Murray's injury time winner at Birmingham stretched our unbeaten run to 16 games. And let's be honest, saw most of us go absolutely disco mental. It was also a win that kept the pressure on leaders Newcastle and kept us 8 points above third going into the festive period. So now we have two home games to see out the final of the year, with the first on Tuesday with QPR visiting, followed by Cardiff on Friday night. Joining me today is, of course, Alan Wares, and we welcome a man whose association with the Albion started in 1977 and saw many ups and downs before he retired in 2009. Ladies and gentlemen, we are delighted to welcome a man whose appearance on the pitch was once greeted with a chant of, "Get your meep out for the lads." It's Malcolm Stewart. Welcome.
Good morning, AD. Good morning, Alan. Nice morning. To be here.
Oh, good stuff. Good to see you at last. I mean, I think we've asked you a few times, but here you are. Lovely to see you. And no references to Harold Shipman, if you don't mind. How are you, mate?
Very well. Doing very well indeed. Lovely to be here this morning with you.
Great stuff.
Especially this time of year.
Well, we ask this of everyone when they come into the studio for the first time, so we have to ask it to you. What are your first memories of the Albion?
First memories would go back to a player we had called Roy Jennings.
He's going back. Black and white.
It would have been, yeah, it was black and white. I remember walking along to the Goldstone because they used to open the gates with 20 minutes to go. So not being able to afford to go and see the game, I used to walk along and go for the last 20 minutes. And I can recall him taking a penalty in an old 4th Division game. Unfortunately, he lifted it not only over the goal but over the north stand as well.
That takes talent. That
and you caught the ball and you brought it back in. And here you go.
No, thing is, in those days, the north stand had a roof, didn't it? So
it did have a roof. It took some doing. Believe me, it did take
so
some doing.
So that's worse than Ujoa, worse than O'Grady. What did he do? Was it non-kicking foot, not beside the ball, leant back?
I think you can say that the pitches were a lot different that day, and I think...
Oh, what's the pitch?
1 foot went, and over the ball went.
Oh, we beckoned it.
Well, I'm going to talk to you about pitches a little bit later on, but let's just get this out of the way quickly. Last Saturday at Birmingham...
Awful for 75 minutes, brilliant for the last 15 minutes. Solly March made the difference. We won 2-1. We're 8 points clear of Reading. Malcolm, so tell us...
You see,
absolutely.
You said you wanted to do it quickly. I couldn't do it quicker.
That was impressive.
Okay.
Right, but I mean,
all I would say, there's one stat, because next week's show is on New Year's Eve. We're going to do a review of 2016. But I would say this one stat that has come up, and I was actually quite surprised, but it's there nonetheless. Murray's goal against Birmingham was Knockhart's first assist of the season.
It was. I've got that one here.
Have you?
I have.
Well, sorry, mate. It's his first assist. Although, having said that, he did take a corner for an own goal at Reading, but yeah.
But I mean, very much like your potted review there, mine was, we're a bit rubbish until Solly March came on and then we won.
Just re-edited, absolutely.
But I mean, Malcolm, obviously you no longer work for the club, but I mean, how much do you actually get to see the Albion in these days?
Yeah, I still get to see them a fair bit. Very impressed with this season. I thought this would be a really hard season from after last year. That's a hell of a knock to take. With the way that we didn't get promoted last year. And I thought it would be maybe after Christmas when we saw the best of them, but these boys are showing great, great mental strength as well as physical abilities to be up there now. And a great gap, 8 points between us and the club below. Fantastic.
So did you think then, I mean, obviously you've been involved with promotion sides and sides that have just missed out. I mean, notably in 1978 after in your first year at the
Southampton Spurs,
very much. I mean, mentally not going up last year in that manner would have left them hurting. So, I mean, to come back and to bounce back in this manner is amazing, isn't it?
Without doubt. I mean, this is shine reminiscent to that year when the following year we were promoted. We evidently got off to a bad start after that year, and that's what I was expecting this year. They've got off to a great start.
So there's no hangover. Okay, well, let's go back to the late 70s, Malcolm. And
first and foremost, most importantly, did you have a perm?
I did have a perm. I did have a perm, believe it or not. Yes.
A Kevin Keegan perm.
Kevin Keegan perm.
Fantastic. What colour is your hair? Because I think it's this nice sort of Christmassy silvery colour at the moment. But
oh, it's a lovely colour at the moment, but it was then brown.
Oh, right.
It stayed brown for a long, long time with the aid of some colour products, I will say.
The
best perm probably around at that time was either Geardy's or John Ruggiero's. Great perms. Couldn't match those two.
But I mean, you came in 77 as youth team physio. Alan Muller was the first team manager. But I mean, it was a very, very, very different time back then. So, I mean, tell us about the club that you came into.
Oh, very, very different. In fact, I've worked with some managers. I never got to work with Peter Taylor, though. He was the manager that formulated me coming into the club. He'd approached John Shepherd to form a youth team. Strange position. We had three apprentice professionals. They didn't get games because we had no youth team. So what you did, you got the local lads together through John Shepherd, and we started trying to bring talent through. Very, very, very difficult at the time, but we were well supported by Alan Mullery, George Aiken, great servant of the club, and we started to get together, something that's now blossomed amazingly.
Mm. So, I mean, Mike Yaxley the physio at the club then, or was it
Mike? Mike was at the club, very, very helpful to me, obviously, in my early days. I was at the time at Southwick Football Club. That's where I knew John from. I was able to continue working at Southwick and with the Albion, but halfway through the first season, it was apparent that actually the reserves never had a physio at all for games. Only when Mike could make games did they have a physio, so they then approached me to see if I could do that. So I then started to do the London Midweek games for the reserves and the youth team on a Sunday, which meant I had to leave Southwick.
Mike actually always reminded me of a dodgy used car salesman.
It was a dark glass, wasn't it? So obviously, knowing what you know now and the way that technology in basically mending football has come, what were your tools of the trade back then? And I suppose also with the youth team, that you probably had to also deal with things like growing pains as well, didn't you?
You, to an extent, that's probably more prevalent now, because at the time we were dealing with mainly 17 to 18 year olds, and nine times out of 10 they'd gone through that. Nowadays, when you've got your squad starting at nine, that's when those problems start occurring. Overuse injuries, growth injuries, that's a major thing now with kids. I see a lot of it still in my clinic, so it's a major thing.
So, I mean, at the time, I mean, when you, obviously, you were 25 when you first came in?
Oh, so just tell everyone, don't
you? I was, I was the same age as most of the people in the first team at the time. Pleasant to be around the club, because obviously, like you guys, I was a supporter of the club.
Yeah. So did you become a physio because you were rubbish at football? Or was it?
Yep, that's. I've played a lot of football when I was younger. I broke my leg quite young, and
Did you fix it yourself?
Well, the funny thing was that it was so difficult to fix that did give me my input as to, look, there must be different ways of doing this.
What was the break then? I mean,
I broke tib and fib playing in a Sunday league match.
A clean shear through.
Yeah, and it was quite funny at the time, because I had a lot of first aid knowledge. It was, yeah. I had a lot of first aid knowledge, and I was the only one in the team that did, even though the team I was playing for was St John. When the physio come on to me, he turned around and said, well, I think you can get up. And I said, no, I don't think I can. And he said, yeah, it's fine. I said, no, I think I've broken it. So we decided that he'd take me to hospital in the back of his Ford Cortina rather than call an ambulance, because he wasn't sure. It was broken.
Yeah, a clean one. So it was a clean break. So was it easier to heal, if you excuse the leg pun?
Funny enough, no, because when you do that, and then we didn't have internal fixation. So I was in a full-length plaster for 14, 16 weeks. And when I came out of that, there was no leg left. And that's when they turned around and said, right, you're healed, off you go. Nowadays, we wouldn't do that. That gave me an interest.
Okay, so you got this gig with the club, obviously the club that you support as well. And it was an exciting time. I mean, things were starting to move on and up. I mean, we just had Brian Clough come in. Bamba presumably was the chairman then, wasn't he?
Without doubt, yeah.
And I mean, how much involvement did you actually have with the first team then?
Very little involvement, other than the fact that when you'd done reserve teams then, the players that weren't playing played. So first team players that were left out did play. So you got to know everyone by coming through the reserves, going into the first team. At the time, it was a wonderful club, well run by Mike Bamber, Alan Mullery, and especially Nobby Houghton, because Nobby made sure that everybody was integrated. So you spoke to everybody. The tea lady knew everybody. Everybody knew the ground cleaners. It was a fantastic place to be. You weren't left out of anything. Great people around the club.
That's an interesting point you make there about, you know, the chairman, the manager, and you know, people say it's, well, Tony Bloom has said it in the past, it's the most important decision he has to make is choosing the right manager. But by the sounds of things, it also probably sounds a manager's most important choice is choosing the captain. Now, in this country, we actually, I think, sort of look at the whole notion of captain and overplay it in comparison to other places. But here it sounds like when you're saying Brian Houghton was effectively, you know, although Mallory had George Aitken, it sounds like Houghton was certainly his right-hand man.
Without a doubt. Nobby run the dressing room. You probably have been to the old Goldstone.
You had
a lovely little setup where you came in from the tunnel and you could actually walk into the dressing room through the little gym that we had. Right. And I actually witnessed Brian after a win at home, a 2-0 win. One of our players pulled out of a tackle right near the end of the game, and he waited in the gym for the player to walk through. He then pinned him against the wall and threatened him that if he ever done that again, he would harm him. And that was a game we'd won. Can you imagine what he was like when we lost?
Absolutely. Well, actually, it's very, very similar. It does follow on directly from Mullery, wasn't it? Who lamped someone when he was playing for Fulham. I mean, Fulham beat Brighton 5-1.
Yeah.
The one was down to this Fulham player just, you know, bottling out of a tackle. Had a right go at him. And I think this is the story that goes, isn't it? And 3 years later, Bamba, who'd remembered that, said, you know, well, when this guy retires.
Yeah.
So, you know, so Houghton was effectively a chip off the old block with Mullery.
That's right. Mullers was a great man, and it still is a great man, great manager. I'm a traditionalist, and I believe the best manager Brighton ever had because of where we were. He took us to the First Division. Hmm. That can be emulated by Chris Hughton, and Chris Hughton would go on to be probably an even better manager in my eyes, but Muller still holds that key. But
well, he's still the only manager to take us to the,
take
to
us
the
to the promised land. Yeah,
it says something about we only do well with ex-Spurs players, I think, don't we? You
know, he's a great man, Muller, for certain things. I mean, he called me into his office once. He arrived early on a Saturday. I was there early because we'd just finished a youth game, and he said, "Come through with a cup of tea." So we come through, and the reason being that on TV's Alan Mullery, he's done an interview for one of the, I think it was St and Greavesy.
All right.
And he then turned around to me and said, "You know what, Mal, there's two types of managers, good managers and lucky managers. Fortunately, I'm both."
I mean, you mentioned Nobby there, but there was some other heroes in that team as well, the likes of Peter Ward, for instance.
Yeah, do you know, I mean, staying on the terraces, staying in the south stand when we beat Walsall, 7-0 with seven goals in the second half. You appreciate how good Wardy was, but I must admit I never appreciated how good he was until he came back on loan to us, and he struggled then to get into the first team.
Yeah.
And he played a number of reserve games, and I was then doing the reserves. He was sensational.
Yeah.
Okay, lovely guy, great ability.
Yeah.
And there's another one who was idolised, but everyone around the club he had time for. Absolutely everybody.
Well, even now he still doesn't have to buy a drink
and I think he makes sure of that as well, doesn't he?
Pretty much.
I actually did see him once open his wallet. There was a colony of moths that flew out, but there was, you know,
I was going to say, I can't recall him ever seeing that wallet open.
No,
there you go.
I did once, you know. It was like, you know, Pandora's box.
It was.
But, I mean, obviously back then, though, I mean, the pitches were heavier. I mean, did that make injury worse, or was it a different kettle of fish?
I think sports scientists nowadays would have their work cut out with being able to sit down with you and say, look, these people are now in the red zone, because that would have happened very early on.
What do you mean by red
pitches.
Zone?
What they do now, they actually, all players are monitored in everything they do. Mm-hmm. And sports scientists will
everything?
Turn around to you. Absolutely everything
Crikey.
They do. And sports scientists will turn around and say, this player's in the red zone. And when he's in the red zone, he's more likely to be injured. Had a great seminar with the medical professionals up in Birmingham 2 years ago. And the way it was done, new sports scientists and physios and old. And it was a battle between the two.
Oh, really?
Because they actually don't think that we knew what we were doing, you know.
Well, the older ones
days,
didn't.
The older ones.
Okay.
And yet we were doing a lot of things that they still do. Now,
but to be honest, I was led to believe that the cure-all for all physios back in the
it was a magic sponge, wasn't it?
It was a bucket of the ice-cold bucket, a sponge straight into the knackers.
Ice-cold water. Do you know what? I can still remember when the FA changed the plastic buckets to aluminium. for safety reasons. I must admit, we had to have that. It was a rule. You had to have them at every dugout. Yeah. Sponge, waters, aluminium buckets.
How very Preston Park.
Very, yeah. But I must admit, we never used that. And right. Preston Park, actually, that brings me to a story about pitches. We had a pre-season friendly against Fulham when Malcolm McDonald was their manager. And they decided to bring the reserves down so we could have a reserve game first, followed by the first team game.
So we're talking late 80s here. So we're still at Goldstone.
So they decided to play it with Dean. But when we turned up to get changed, there were holes everywhere because they'd been shot put in. So we decided that you actually couldn't play it with Dean. So we phoned round and they said, change there. We've got a pitch at Preston Park. So we played Albion v Fulham Reserves on the bottom pitch at Preston Park.
Down by Andy Rollins Cafe.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I recall standing there and it was a very good game played at high tempo. And this person walked past and he said to me, what's the score? I said, it's 2-1. He said, who's playing? I said, it's Brighton and Fulham Reserves. He went, no need for that. He said, I was being quite polite to you, he said, and you can't speak to me. You wouldn't believe it. Brighton and Fulham Reserves.
Yeah, serves me right for asking. So I just want to go back to this thing about the red zone. So we're talking about the technology of then and now. So when did you have what you called a red zone back then? I mean, when you're saying a player is in the red zone, you're saying they're more liable for injury because, what, they're not running correctly or they're not...
Yeah, they're more when their energy fields are lower, they're more likely to pick up injury. Now, we didn't have the technology they had then, but you know what we used to do? I mean, I go into clubs now and they've got iPads, and a player has to come in the morning and go on the iPad and register how he feels, how he slept, any problems at home. Now, what we used to do was speak to players.
Mm. And you'd have to assume that they were going to be honest.
That's right. And, you know, players will be. I mean, are they going to be any more honest on an iPad? No, so you spoke to them, you watched them, you knew how they were feeling, you spoke...
Body language and...
Yeah, okay. And you spoke to managers and coaches and they spoke to you. And so it's gone on. Now it can be proved, they would turn around and say. But then, as we said, you know, if you're in the lower leagues and you're dealing with a squad of 18 and the sports scientist says, well, 7 of them are in the red zone.
Mm. Well, there's not a great deal you can do, is there?
Yeah. Mm. You know, you're going to play them. Yeah. So...
And also, I mean, a player will want to play irrespective of how they feel, you know.
Correct.
Because to not play means they're going to get dropped for the next few weeks, and they could end up sort of hurting themselves on the back of a lie.
That's true. Well, I mean, you were telling me a story about Jimmy Case in that. Exactly the same thing.
Speaking to Jimmy, we're talking about rotation, which Jimmy didn't like.
Is this when he was manager?
This was before he was manager as a player.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
And he said when he was at Liverpool, they used to regularly win three tournaments a season, but with a squad of 16 or 17 players. And he said the reasoning behind it, that their pay scale was not the best, but if they won and got very good bonuses, now at the end of the season those bonuses were divided by how many games they played.
Okay.
So Jimmy said, if I got sent off for an unnecessary thing, I had Sammy Lee, Terry McDermott waiting to take my place.
Yeah, we're not going to be talking rubbish here, are we?
No, you know, he said I'd never get back in. So at the end of the year my wages would be down. And he said that was the secret behind Liverpool, the good bonuses, you know, and making sure they had good players.
I mean, honestly, I don't remember, you know, the thing about Liverpool, certainly under Shankly and then under Paisley, it was all about the passing game, where, you know, where previously the whole idea was just to get the ball forward as quickly as possible. But, you know, Shankly brought in this whole passing thing, which is, you know, it's obvious now, but in those days it won Liverpool trophies year after year. Well, it made them the best team in Europe, and one of the best in the world. But it was on the back of, and when you look at these people now, they're just sort of regular guys. We talk about Jimmy Case, we talk about Sammy Lee, who turned up here for 5 minutes and then got off to Southampton, but Terry McDermott, another perm. It was really good, exciting stuff. But it wasn't, you know, they'd also know how to kill a game. In those days, you could back pass, and the amount of times that the ball just got passed back to Clements in goal, pick it up, hoof it down the pitch, and what have you. But they won on the back of actually being fairly conservative in their amount of energy they expended. Correct. Of course, when they didn't have the ball, you know, fine, they'd work hard to get it back. But when they did get the ball, it was just, you know, it was actually kind of 10, 15 years ahead of its time.
You were at Anfield probably in the FA Cup game, where we drew 2-2. I remember being 2-0 down, and they put 21 passes together in one movement. And I remember Martin Inch would turn around to me and saying, this could be a very long afternoon. but, hey, what a great result that was at
the end. Absolutely, including crumpling Megan John Barnes twice.
Okay, so you involved with the reserves. So when we got promoted to the first division, and obviously we got to an FA Cup final in that spell as well. So
yeah.
Did you have much involvement with the team then? Were you on the helicopter?
I was on the helicopter, but we were at the club to call the staff up to the Hilton Hotel to watch we had a lovely time beforehand, watched the helicopter come in, which by the way nearly didn't fly because of fog.
It was a murky day, wasn't
it? Nearly had to get on the coach, but it was great. And that evening going back to the Brighton Centre for the Cup Final banquet was fantastic, absolutely fantastic. And I'll tell you what, the fantastic thing there was when Jimmy Melia got up and made a speech and praised the save that Gary Bailey made, not the miss. You know, Smith must score, but it was a hell of a save. You know, we have to say that.
There's still rankles, though. It's only 33 years on.
I know, yeah.
I know.
To be fair, we were at the following year, the first round of the FA Cup, and we were away to Arsenal in the reserve competition.
Right.
And then, as we said, Football.com used to play, the first team could be at home, you know, playing a big club, and we'd be at Highbury playing Arsenal. And Gordon Smith was in the party, and we were watching the football prior to the game, and the FA Cup come on, and he said, you know what, everyone is going to remember that miss. Nobody remember I scored the first goal. Do you know what, he's right.
It's true. But I mean, it was, I mean, the players we had in that team, though, I mean, we shouldn't have really gone down with that squad, really. But
yeah, that it's one of those things, you know, you look at it and you do think to yourself, yeah, we shouldn't have gone down. But when you look at the cup run, we had a lot of luck. And that luck seemed to end with that save from Gary Bailey.
Mm.
And
I think we were down anyway.
The replay didn't go so well, did it?
Yeah.
But I mean, obviously, a massive thing in that game was the injury to Chris Ramsey.
It's funny you should say that. I bumped into Chris last year at Southampton. And when he walked down the corridor and shook my hand, I said, this is the lad that cost us the FA Cup. And he said...
I blame Whiteside, actually. Yeah. But, you know, he was the one that crocked him.
Chris did, yeah.
Yeah, I think we all do, mate, believe me. I mean, Whiteside is not particularly welcome down here. Yeah. So when you're actually dealing with, you know, the reserves, and let's say you're playing, you know, you're there on the dugout with the reserves. So what you've got is that it's not just sort of youth team players. You're also talking about players who are coming back from injury. But also you had that with, you know, you'd have at the Goldston or wherever it is they might play it, you know, someone big from Arsenal coming back, or you know, from injury, or someone from, you know, from Manchester United. Manchester United, because it was only local. But
when I used to be a ball boy, I used to do the reserve games as well, which they were much, much more fun, because you used to have the likes of Glenn Hoddle and Charlie Nicholas, and all these big players of the
day. And I bet you'd have loved their mullets, wouldn't you?
And the thing is, we were half time entertainment as well. We used to go and have a kickabout on the Goldstone pitch as well. I mean,
how bad the pitch was.
Yeah. We played Spurs once in a combination at home.
Yeah.
We had a team of youngsters, and they had Vila and Ardiles playing. And the first half, we've gone in winning 1-0, thinking this is easy. Unfortunately, we never touched the ball second half. Whoever was in charge of Spurs at the time obviously let them know, and Ardiles was absolutely sensational for the second 45 minutes.
I can imagine.
That was, you know,
probably the greatest player of his time. I mean, that's another thing. You talk about teams that are underperforming. That Spurs team, you know, you bear in mind, all right, it was built around Ardiles, Villa to a lesser extent, but it had Hoddle and it had, you know, some, you know, well, Ray Clements had joined by then.
Yeah.
And you think, why didn't they do better?
Probably so they didn't have two defensive midfield players.
Mm.
Would you want them to have? No.
No. Just give the ball to Ozzy and...
That's it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Eddie Packham, I'm here with Alan Wears and Malcolm Stewart, and we are, of course, brought to you in association with oldfootballshirts.com, and I'm just handing over this week's very lovely shirt of the week to Al. And Malcolm, if you could just describe this beautiful shirt for me.
Absolutely sensational. Joma, that was one of the kits that we never actually wore. Red and white stripes, very reminiscent of the old Southampton shirt. But this is...
I think I recognise it. Can I quickly have a quick look at that badge and take it from you? Yeah, that's...
No, trust me, you don't.
Well, it says Karis Karya, BK46 on the badge. I was about to say, I thought it looked like Red Star Belgrade, but I don't think that's going to be that.
It actually looks very much like an Atletico Madrid shirt, actually. But it's not that.
What has Uncle Phil given us this week, Adrian? Tell us all.
Here you go, then. This is the home shirt of the Finnish club, so it's practically the North Pole.
Lapland, anyway.
And it is Boldklubben 46, or BK46, as they're known. It's a sports club from Karis, which is in Raceburg in Finland. The club was formed in 1946, and the main activities covered are football and handball, with large junior sections in both disciplines. BK46 men's team currently play in the Kakunen, which is the second division, which is the third level of...
I think Phil's making it all up, isn't he? Just to trip you up, isn't he?
Their home ground is the Karis Sportplan, and the chairman of the club is Alif Oosterholm. BK46 was founded in 1946, with the outset specialising in sports, football and handball. So, the club has been more successful at handball, and the men's team have won the SM Championship 20 times. Current players include Tom Grunes, midfielder Tobias Fagerström, and striker Kasper Kjellberg. There you go. And Merry Christmas from all at Old Football Shirts.
Well, thank you for that, Phil. So did you say when that shirt is from?
We don't actually know.
Because it does actually look, even though with all the sponsorship and everything, it makes it look modern, but actually the style of it actually does look kind of retro.
Their club side from, like, they might as well be playing in Preston Park.
But all I'm saying is put a lot of thought into it.
Finland, Christmas. He's put a lot of thought into it. Yeah. Love that.
No flies on Phil.
You put a lot of thought into that one, Phil, didn't you? Yeah. A lot.
Yeah.
None at all. Malcolm, you've had some very successful times with the club, but I mean, we do need to talk about the dark times
Why didn't you hit Bellotti more often?
To be fair, I used to hurt him more by smiling at him every morning. I knew it. I knew he hated that, so I made.
Tell us about how you know, because obviously you were there. You wouldn't have been sort of party to all the shenanigans, but I mean, it all started with this extraordinary general meeting in November '93. But you know, when did you get the first inklings that there was going to be trouble?
Probably when we weren't paid. It was. To be fair, it's quite dark times. And recently, I was cleaning out some books and come across Build the Bonfire.
Oh yeah,
and I read it again and sat there and thought, amazingly, I worked through that period.
But you didn't get paid.
Worked, but didn't get paid.
So were you protected from everything that was going on,
You couldn't be protected. Bear in mind that I live locally. I'm a supporter of the club, and working for the club didn't make it any easier. One of the first things that happened, obviously, was that we had a colour personnel at the club. And these were people that I'd worked with that worked hard for the club, and they all left within 1 week. Everyone had had letters reported to David Bellotti at 5 to 5, and they'd left the building by 5 o'clock. And that was, you know, very sad times.
Sure. I mean, that sounds daffing to say, but you were the club's main physio by then, weren't you?
I was the club's only physio then.
So if you fell over, so when did you actually take that gig on?
That was offered to me in 89.
Right.
I'd worked with Barry with the reserves, and I'd actually come to the period.
That's Barry Lloyd.
Barry Lloyd. I'd come to the period where I was now due to qualify at Lillishaw, and that then gave me, the sort of choice of, did I stay doing what I was doing, or did I look to try and move on to a club? And I was thinking that I perhaps would have to move on. Unfortunately, Mark Leather had never really settled down here. He's very much a northern lad. He gave his notice in, and Barry asked me if I wanted to take over. So, you know, absolutely yes. What I wanted to do, come at the right time for a local lad, how could you say no to that?
So that was 89, did you say?
I mean,
we had a really decent side then. I mean, the likes of, Gary Nelson was there.
Yeah. Brems and Nelson up front.
That was a terrific time. And that probably the last days of the Goldstone, really. The last.
Even though it was about 6 or 7 years still to go. But, we had a decent side, and then you could see that, you know, from the early 90s onwards, it was just bit by bit by bit. And you must have experienced that, because you see, like I say, not withstanding a culled staff, but also along the lines of just things weren't happening. You felt that, you know, you said earlier Bamba ran the club very well, but you could see, I'm sure you could see, that we had, you know, Greg Stanley running the place, and then Bill Archer took over and what have you, and you could tell that there was a lack of professionalism there.
Without doubt, there was a lack of professionalism. There seemed to be, how could you put it, it seemed as though the football became secondary to what was going on. And of course, at a football club, that can never be right.
Sure.
Never be right. Difficult, very, very difficult times. To be fair, sometimes you sat and listened to David talk, and he seemed quite plausible. And in fact, sometimes I had to pinch myself and say, "What are you doing? You believe in it?"
Hang on, this is Bellotti.
That's right. Yeah. Even though he once told me that as a trained politician, he'd been taught never to tell the truth, that you avoided the truth at all costs.
I think he excelled at that.
He did, without doubt. He took his trade on full time. One of the things that he once said to me, he turned around and said, "These are dark times, but when we get our stadium," both you, me, and Jock Riddell, the famous kick man.
Jock was wonderful.
Yeah. He said, "All three of us will be in that stadium." Well, for different reasons, none of us were. At least I went there as a spectator. But it would have been a travesty for that man to have walked into a stadium that, without a doubt.
Especially when you know what's happened since 20 years.
Some very funny times at that time. I mean,
go on.
After one game, I can recall, we went into his office. Jimmy was the manager, so used to go into Jimmy's office to drink
Case.
After a game. Yeah. And David Bellotti was in there, and the fans were outside, and they were chanting Bellotti out and other things that we
and
can't
other things
mention.
But can't put on the radio. But
so he promptly got onto his phone and he called the police.
Bellotti did.
Yep. You could hear the sirens in the background, and then you heard something like 200 people run off. So the police arrived, they knocked on the window, and they went, "There's nobody here." He went, "No." He said, "I think you've had the desired effect. Thank you for coming along. Are you sure you're okay now?" "Absolutely perfect." So the police went. As the police went, you could hear the 200 come back. And they started again. I thought it was hilarious. Absolutely hilarious.
I mean, when you were hearing this, you could hear Bellotti out and all the various things you couldn't hear. I mean, there must have been... You, how did you hide that smile? How did you hide that... Yes.
Well, often you didn't. You smiled. let's face it.
Did he not care? I mean, did he not care? I mean, you know, you hear this scream. Did he understand why people wanted him out?
I think he thoroughly understood. I think he was there for one thing and one thing only.
Which was?
To sell that stadium.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he...
Trouser is
all else,
his cut.
Yeah. Yeah, you had to, you know, come home to us, because they were very, very nearly successful. They were one game away from succeeding, because we'd already lost the stadium. So when we went to Hereford, had we been relegated, then we wouldn't have gone into the conference. You couldn't, because we were ground sharing. The rules of the conference were, so we would have gone to the Ryman's League. You know, our local derby would have
even
been
worthy.
Even
though Dick Knight had promised, "I won't abandon you," etc., etc.
That's right.
I mean,
yeah.
I'm sure he wouldn't have done, but we'd have had to have started from so much further back.
I used to do some work for the County FA, and the morning of the Hereford game, I was just about to leave home, and I got a phone call from the then secretary, David Worsford, and he said, he was checking some dates with me, and he said, "By the way," he said, "I wonder if anyone's thought that should you lose tomorrow, do you realise you can't play your reserves in the Senior Cup next year?" And I said, "I've got to say, David, I don't think that's hit anybody's attention as yet."
Yes.
Great pre-planning.
Yeah. Well, fair enough. You know,
well,
just
there's
disaster recovery.
There's an old adage that when you're playing well and the team's successful, that no one's injured, everyone's desperate to be in the side. Yeah, but when things are going wrong, everyone's got a slight knock.
I was about to say, do you think there's
did you have that going on at that time?
Yeah, and listen, I've spoken to players about this, and people turn around and say, "Well, you know what, they're cheating." No, they're not. There's the psychological, you know, some days we have good days, some days we have bad days. Okay, and it's about taking on board. Now, when you're playing well, when you're up the top and you're winning games and you can't see yourself losing, you get a knock and you think, "Okay, I'm feeling it, but that's not going to keep me out." But when you're doing badly and you know everyone's relying on you, and you think, "Oh, if I can't do what I can, if I let them down," and that's the feeling. That's when they come to you for a decision. "Can you have a look at me? I don't feel right." And that's nobody cheating. It's the psychological psychology of a player.
Almost.
Yeah, you know, you've got to speak to them. I was quite fortunate to have a lot of very honest players. Sometimes the hardest thing I had was to get players to stop playing, because, you know, I'd never let a player play if it was going to actually make him worse. Mm. So you sometimes had that problem. Rarely I had the other side, but I have had it. Yeah.
So basically, what you're saying is you were part doctor, part agony uncle.
Oh, merit, very much so.
Parish priest. Yeah. And
yeah. Every it's different now at a club. I mean, you see the stars at club now, but when I first come into the club, you know, Mike actually was the physio, and I was a part-time help, and there was a club doctor. That was the medical staff. Nowadays, you'll have fitness coaches, rehab coaches, sports scientists. They're full-time doctors. When I first went to the club, we had a wonderful doctor, a gentleman called Dr. Sless. Lovely, lovely gentleman. Unfortunately, we had to say that sports injuries wasn't his first choice. He was a gynaecologist by trade. And a very good one.
I thought he was going to say a vet.
Very, very good gynaecologist, which... But we really didn't need him that much in that capacity.
Well, to be honest, then he should have been working at the cricket club because they're really good at that.
Oh.
Love that.
No, no. It's Christmas, AD. You can't do things like that.
A jingly jing.
No. So that was basically, it was you three, a table and an aluminium bucket. That was it.
That's it. We were one of the first clubs to put in football so we could have the hot and cold really on tap.
Yeah.
Well, we've got to ask you about the Doncaster game, which was, of course, the last game at the Goldstone. Now, going into that game, obviously, you were on the bench for that game. Did it occur to you, my God, this is the last game? Because you were going there as a supporter and as an employee of the club. I mean, how did you feel?
I actually ran into the club that day. I used to run a lot then, believe it or not. You wouldn't think so.
It
now.
Shows, no?
And running through Hove Park, you know, you just felt really, really sad. The whole day, you had the feeling of sadness, but also one of desperately, desperately needing a result. Mm. Now, it was quite funny because when Steve Gritt took over, I think David Blotti felt that I would be out the door because he turned around to me the day before and said, we've got a new manager coming in. You don't know him. He said, but we've given him carte blanche to change the staff. He'll have the staff he wants. Unfortunately, I knew Alan Kirbyshe very well. His best mate, Steve Gritt, so mm-hmm. I knew very well Steve was coming in. Mm. I'd met Steve, and when he came in with Blotti to introduce him, the fact he shook my hand and gave me a hug really didn't please David at all. And I did feel sorry for Steve because, as he quite rightly pointed out, on his first day at the club, there were protests. Mm-hmm.
It was graffiti, said, wasn't there?
Yeah, and he said he didn't mind the graffiti, but they had spelt Grit wrong.
Yeah, they had.
Yeah.
with one T, wasn't it?
And he said, look at that, they can't even spell my name right.
Well, yeah, I mean, never underestimate the parish. But the thing is, in the build-up, you had Doncaster and you fell into that. But also, I mean, before that, in the games, the home games leading up to it, I mean, obviously, as the season got more and more, we were getting better, and it looked like there was going to be the resolution of Dick Knight at the centre for Diddle, and Bill Archer was, you know, looks like he was on out the door. But you were sitting on the bench knowing full well, and in fact actually experiencing pitch invasions. I mean, did you ever fear for, well, either for yourself or for the players?
The York game, we had people coming into the shop the week of the game, and they were saying, 14th minute, beware the 14th minute. Now, I think absolutely everybody thought that the invasion was going to start from the North Stand. So on that day, we got to 12 minutes, and I always used to say to the subs to warm up. So I said to them, 12 minutes, warm up, lads, that way towards the North Stand. I remember Ross Johnson saying, are you mad? Yeah. Are you mad? Do you know what's going to happen? So off they went to warm up, and of course, when the bang come, they all come from the south end. But the funny thing was, we come off the pitch, and we locked the referee in the dressing room. And he turned and said, I don't think this is necessary. So Jim said, I'd rather we locked you in. And there were this tremendous bang where they run down and charge the doors. And then the next thing we heard was this like click, clock, click, clock, click, clock. And these policemen come from nowhere. Evidently, they've been in the boardroom.
They're wearing clogs.
Well, they're tripping down the stairs and they've walked down. They're in riot gear. Yeah. They're in riot gear and everything. Yeah. Where did they come from? God knows what time they come from.
Sometimes I really wish some referees have riot gear. Yeah.
I wonder if we've let him out yet, that referee.
Well, the bulldozers are there. He's still under there, under Toys R Us. So did you ever fear for... I mean, all right, you know, with the York City game, you knew what was coming. Fine, but...
I didn't fear for his safety because I knew that the people involved, I knew exactly what they were doing and why they were doing it.
And you supported them?
Yes, yeah. As I said, you know, there was nothing. I mean, we spoke to some of them from time to time to try and ease the situation, because I knew that the force of law would be used against them. Mm. So we tried to make sure that didn't happen. Mm. But you respect everything they did.
Sure. So what was the attitude of the players? I mean, you said, obviously, you, as a Brighton fan, you saw the way that the club was being run so appallingly. I mean, were the players sympathetic? Obviously, they've got their jobs, they've got their, you know, their livelihoods. They're getting paid, they're not getting paid, but, yeah, you know.
By then, the players were very sympathetic to what was happening. Mm. The players realised what was happening. They could see from internally how the club was being run down. And the one thing that those players desperately wanted to do that season was to keep the club up.
Yeah.
And the Doncaster game, I mean, a great story. I don't know if anyone's told you it, but when we started against Doncaster, you know, we felt we had a great chance of getting a result that day. But they came close four or five times from set ball pieces for the big centre half they had. And, you know, we're looking at it and thinking, we can't stop this lad. Mm. We can't dominate him. So Ian Baird, very, very good professional player, got tangled with him on the halfway line, provoked a fight, so they both got sent off. And I can remember Bairdy walking past us going, not bad, a king for a pawn.
Yeah.
And that, as much as anything, won us that game by removing that player from the pitch. Now, people talk about professionalism. That was the guy at his best.
Such a cynicism, but if that means that actually, you know, we bottomed out then, and, you know, we were able.
That's right.
And you look at what happened with Doncaster the following year. It was them that kept us from, again, from being relegated, because they were they suffered even more indignance. You know, the chairman set fire to their crowd.
Well, I do remember going to Doncaster. It was just before Christmas, I believe. Mm. And I think it was 0-0. And I was sitting there, and I do remember thinking to myself, what on earth am I doing?
I think a lot of people felt that agility.
Their fans then started to conger, I believe, and so did theirs, and the fans changed ends. It was surreal, you know.
That sounds about right. But yeah, so within the Goldstone, you know, there couldn't be open and active support. I think, as I understand it, people did talk to Stuart Storer sort of quietly, saying, look, you know, we understand what's going on here.
Yeah.
And that was the case with all the players.
That's right. The players knew, and we used to have a chat about it. I mean, I'd done an article when we were leaving the Goldstone. Andy Naylor had spoken to me about injuries, and he then said to me, I know what's going on, and I would love to do a story, he said, but I can't because nobody put their name to it.
Mm.
So I said to him, I will. And he said, you know the repercussions. Now, as far as I was on borrowed time, if Bellotti was always going to get rid of me at some stage.
Yeah.
So I said to him, listen, if it helps, I'll do it. So I did. It really did hit the fan after that when it was published, and Bellotti called me in. His belief was that I'd signed a form to say that I couldn't speak to the press, which I hadn't. I'd refused to sign it.
Yeah.
He couldn't produce that for me by signature on, so therefore he couldn't sack me.
Yeah.
And he told Steve Gritt at the time he needed to sack me, and Steve said no, he wouldn't.
Right.
So fortunately I stayed, and eventually Bellotti did go.
Well, the thing is then, you know, with Dick coming in sort of quite quickly, and then you'd have had, I think, I guess that probably the club that Dick had to form for the following year up at Gillingham, he had to keep it as consistent from the previous year as possible. He wasn't in a position to actually just throw the grenade in and say, all right, let's start again.
That's
so
right.
you carried on Gillingham.
Yeah, yes, didn't we just?
Well, let's just draw a line under that for a minute, though, because I've got a pop quiz for you.
Oh,
I know, it's very, very exciting. But because, I mean, you've been there from 1977 to 2009. That's a very, very long time. So, what is the best manager you work for?
Best manager I work for would have to be Steve Coppell. Steve's a fantastic manager. Probably wasn't the club long enough for us to see the best of what he had. Most successful manager, obviously, I worked with was Mickey for the two promotions, even though he wasn't there for the second year. And Mullers for what he'd done. But one of the unsung ones has to be Barry Lloyd for what he achieved. Next year, it's 25 years since we got to the playoff final.
Mm.
Now, of all the years I spent at the club, I've never ever had a year like that. The players that we got together, which basically were a bunch of misfits, they were people that had been released through injury, through age, Lloydy got them together. He went and got two absolute icons in Budgie and Smalley
to
play up front, and we ended up having a run all the way to Wembley. Could have been one of the first Premiership clubs.
But the thing is, if we'd have gone on
not with that kit,
how different would things have been if we had? Because we started after that. That's when things started going backwards,
right.
Really, wasn't it?
The money that we'd have got from that, I think, would have saved the club, but. You
can't help feeling that Archer just came in, saw that it was a prized asset, didn't care about the football, and then just sort of like torpedoed the whole place.
Without a doubt.
Okay.
Yeah.
Next one. Biggest sick note.
Cool. That's it. Drop them in it. Yeah. I just hope they're not listening, AD.
Must admit, with the biggest sick note, most times on the pitch to Leon Knight. Never once saw him injured. Gary Hobson, Gary could spend some time with me. Stuart Storer, another one could spend some time with me.
Yeah.
Stuart,
maybe they just liked you.
Well, Stuart is, as a professional footballer, was allergic to leather and grass. Would you believe that?
Hang on, didn't he then take up driving lesson, driving instructor?
And Nell works at Loughborough, I believe.
Yes, but he does,
yeah. Was allergic to grass and leather. Greatest, and we spoke about this, touched on this earlier, one of the biggest, bravest things I've ever seen was from our mate Adam Virgo.
Right.
Who is needlephobic.
Is he?
He's needlephobic. But when we stayed up in our last game against Ipswich under Mark McGee, the 2 weeks before, he'd actually done his cartilage and he was going to undergo surgery. And the week before, we won our game, which meant that we were going into the last game of the season against Ipswich, needing a win or a draw to stay up.
Mm-hmm.
And he approached me to see if he could have an injection to play. Now, you've got to ask yourself, when you're needlephobic, you know, I said to him, are you sure? Mm. So we spoke to the powers that be, and I said, first thing, speak to the gaffer. Waste of time, he's not going to play yet. The gaffer said, if he can play, I'm playing him. So we took him in on the Thursday. It was a Sunday game. Had the injection. He sat there bravely with his girlfriend's hand looking as though it's going to be broken. He was gripping it so hard. And to be fair, when he went white and nearly fainted, we did have to put him into a cubicle for a little while.
Yep, in the recovery position. Yeah,
Virgs did play, and he gave away the first goal.
Yes, he did.
But he scored the equaliser.
Yep,
he did.
And we stayed up.
Yes.
So, bravery.
So, big brave boy, and you gave him a boiled sweet for it. And
there you go.
Okay.
But the look on his face when he had that jab will always stay with
me. To be fair, he's always got that look on his face, even when he's on Channel 5.
Okay, next one. Player you'd invite for Christmas dinner?
That would be Ian Chapman.
Yeah.
The only person that would eat more than me.
Biggest ground you proposed to someone at?
That could be Old Trafford, that one.
Really? Do tell. Who was there? Me?
There was, do you know, it sounds funny now, but I actually didn't think that anybody had realised who it was. But
Malcolm Fitzstewart Club Physio? Well, maybe...
When the names come up, evidently Gary O'Reilly was on radio and he went, hold on a minute, that's funny, that could be... I reckon that's Mel there, and of course, that did take off, actually.
Mm.
The fortunate thing was that she said no. And it was through her saying no that I've met my present wife, and
all right.
So things did work out
Turn a different corner, in the end.
But yeah, it was quite an experience.
What happened at the game afterwards?
Well, can I just say, actually, when it comes to proposals, let that be an abject lesson to everyone. Do not propose in front of everyone else.
The lads, as you know, great bunch of lads. So the following week, we're bolting away.
Yeah.
So as we got off the coach at the hotel, they're all standing there holding their sides, and I'm thinking, something's not right. And as I got off, they've got the biggest wedding fair they could hold in the Northwest at this hotel. So the lads found that funny, but even funnier was the fact that where we ate was an old chapel. And we used to eat after the lads, and I felt it very strange that when we walked in, they were all still sitting there. So as we walked to our table, we'd been positioned at the bottom of the aisle, and they had the wedding march played as we walked down. So, you know, very sympathetic to the cause, the lads. Yeah. Extremely.
But you just think, I remember, lads, I mend your cartridges here. So, you know.
You can always, at one stage, you're always going to be on the bed. You can always get your own back.
Yeah.
But, I mean, during your time at the club, there's been, when you first started, Mike Bamber was there, and he was throwing money around and putting people on 10-year contracts, etc.
Yeah.
And, you know, things... went down, and there wasn't always an awful lot of money around, was there? So what happened when Jeff Pitcher came to see you?
As we said, like, you had to count every penny. And of course, Jeff's come in to me and he's injured, and we assessed him and we felt that we knew exactly what was wrong. Jeff wondered if we could have an MRI scan, but I didn't feel there was any need. That morning in training, Bobby got injured and came in, and we sent Bobby immediately for an MRI scan. Juggling the balls in the air. Now, Jeff Pitcher's right leg or Bobby's left leg, which would you have scanned? Mm. It's always going to be Bobby's.
Isn't it? Yes.
But
how did Jeff feel about it? Thanks. Yeah.
Oh, no, Jeff took it like the person he is. Good character, Jeff. I mean, the first day I met him, I was asked to go and meet Mickey and a player and take him for medical. Mm-hmm. So I turned up to meet Jeff, and he said, I want you to do a medical on this lad. So I went to shake his hand, and he had to take his arm out of a sling, and it was in plaster, for me to do the medical. And I said to him, are you sure about this, gaffer? And he went, oh no, don't worry about that. But he's a character, Jeff.
But that's an interesting point you made there, which is because, I mean, all the players that came in, you had to do the medicals on them, so presumably not everyone actually passed that.
No. There were two or three that I didn't pass.
And we still signed them,
most,
probably.
Yeah, we actually did with two famous ones, Ian Culverhouse, who I quite blankly said to Nobby that I couldn't pass, and he said, doesn't matter, I'm still signing him. What a player he turned out to be. And Simon Morgan, you know, and
I've said this before, it sounds like he's building a shed when he runs.
But yeah, what a player, you know. What
he didn't train at all or anything, did he?
He trained very rarely. Mick managed him very well, but great player.
Is it true he used to sit whilst everyone else was training, he used to sit there and read the Sun,
just sit there and drink tea? And
I seem to think it was Daily Mirror, actually. They did on days. I mean Morgs would train in some days and he'd do his own work in the gym. We did have a session in, we used to go to Ballygar for pre-season, lovely place to go.
You want to see the look that Malcolm just gave there? It's a shame that no one can see this in super reverb vision. But
it was a place where all you could do was train, and that's what we used to do. But Mick wanted a game, 11v11 game, and I wouldn't allow Morgs to play. And he turned around to me and said, come on, you're going to ruin the whole thing. And I said, listen, at some stage in the season, we'll have a player sent off. You'll play 10. Mm. 3 games into the season, we have a player sent off, we're playing with 10, and he turned around to me and said, well, actually, that wasn't a bad idea, So, you know, prepare for everything.
Yeah, that's exactly how it... Well, the thing is, Gus used to do that a hell of a lot, actually, didn't he? You know, the number of players that we got sent off, and they do a hell of a lot of training of 11v10. And you also get the feeling that some clubs don't do that, because, you know, the first thing they do is just pack defence, whereas actually, although everyone has to work a bit harder, you can actually still carry on playing.
Do you know, we had a game, you may remember it, we played against 9 men at Withdean, and we lost the game 1-0.
Oh, yeah. That was one of the very... I think I missed 5 games in my time in our time at Withdean, and that was one of them.
Good game to miss, Al. It was against Crewe. They scored. They had 9 men. We couldn't break them down. But you know what?
We've been to Hull.
We've been to Hull.
Yeah.
We'd gone down to 9 men and beat them.
Yeah.
2-0.
Okay.
So... Yeah, it happens.
Okay, we are running out of time, so just need to do this a couple of other things. So 13th of September 2005, does that ring any bells with you?
13th of September 2005, it should do.
There was a game against Sheffield United.
That's correct, that's it.
Yes, what happened?
Well, the Sheffield, great support they get in Sheffield. I went onto the pitch, and of course the normal thing happens. UFAT B was...
Yep.
And I walked past what I made used to make sure that I always walked past their fans to show them you weren't going to be intimidated. Mm-hmm. So it got louder and louder, so I just stood there and conducted it, which they thought was actually fantastic. They gave me a round of applause, and as I walked away, the chant then started to get your things out for the lads. So it was a fantastic... Yeah.
And did you?
No, I didn't. Although I did. At the time, I was carrying a pair, and I could have.
I believe you did that at Cheltenham, though.
Yes. Well, again, at Cheltenham, I got some tremendous stick from their fans. And then in the second half, they had 2 players down. I went on to treat one of their players because their physio was involved and got a round of applause coming off.
Yeah. Funny people, fans. Yeah. But what happened was you admitted to a breach of FA Rule E3, apparently, which is abusive and insulting words towards a match official. And you were suspended from all match play involvement for one match, which by the looks of it, was quite a good match to miss.
Crystal Palace,
that's the one we lost 5-0.
Yeah. So it was your fault we lost.
I wasn't even allowed in the dressing room.
Who deputised for you then?
On that day, Matt Miller.
Right.
Done it on that day.
Stretch.
And I was at the game, but.
Without actually sort of saying exactly, what did you do that got you into trouble?
I disagree with the wording they used, but unfortunately I was told that I should agree to the charge, which I did.
Right.
One of our players was brought down and was hurt, and the referee played it on, and the fourth official standing there seemed to indicate he dived, which he didn't. And I let my feelings be known, and that irritated the fourth official, who called the referee over.
Oh, right, so you mouthed off to the fourth official?
Correct.
Right.
Yes. Which you shouldn't do, which was wrong, and it cost me a lot of money. It cost me £250 in a fine. Very fortunately, that weekend, I won the Milo 200 Club, which was exactly £250. So it went in that account and went out of that account.
Yeah, but so it sounds you were...
And just quickly, I mean, we have to do this another time, I think, but I mean, the worst injury you've ever seen, I'm guessing, was Jim McNulty.
I must admit, I was going to write a book, and I actually started it. I've done the title.
Which
and the
is?
Title was, At Least Nobody Died. But Jim tried his hardest to. It was horrendous what happened to Jim.
Such a freak accident as well.
Absolutely. You've seen that so many times. To his undying credit, his parents were there that day. He did not want to be stretched off.
No.
And
he'd have been in screaming agony, wouldn't he?
He was in a lot of pain. Now, we examined him, and whilst we had an idea of what was happening, we did keep him at the club until he passed urine. It was then that we knew what he'd done.
Right.
But we didn't know the full extent. When we heard the full extent of what had happened to him, then...
Was it something like 90% of one of his kidneys had...
Absolutely shattered.
Yeah. Right.
The surgeon that operated said it was reminiscent to somebody having a motorcycle accident.
Wow. And it was just such a glancing blow off his
Correct.
Opponent.
Yeah.
Okay. And just quickly, just before we go, one last question. Best player in your time at the club?
I would say, without a doubt, Mark Lawrenson. I thought absolutely outstanding, could play in different positions.
And he never came to see you?
I think the only time I treated Loro was...
broke his arm?
No, it's when he'd come down to do a TV thing after he'd retired, and I think he had a hangover the following day. I think it's the only time I treated him. But in my time, Bobby Zamora was absolutely outstanding.
We're going to have to get you back in, I think, Malcolm, because we're out of time. We've got so many more stories. But
absolutely love to come back at any time, fellas.
So on that note, we just have to say thank you very much for listening over the last year. We're doing the season, the 2016 review next week. So look out on our Facebook page and on our Twitter. We'll be doing some sort of top five. Don't know what it is yet, but we're
going to have a stat fart like you wouldn't believe.
We are indeed. So that just leaves us to say happy Christmas, everyone. Have an absolutely brilliant time, and
we'll see you next week.
And this is a little something for our friends up the road.
Hey, jingity jing, it's Dominic the donkey. Jingity jing, the Italian Christmas donkey. La 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 la. Santa's got a little friend, his name is Dominic. The cutest little donkey, you'll never see him kick. When Santa visits his paisans with Dominic, he'll be. Because the reindeer cannot climb the hills of Italy. Hey, jingity jing, it's Dominic the donkey. Jingity jing, the Italian Christmas donkey. La la la, la 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 la. La la la, la 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 la. Jingle bells around his feet and presents on the sled. Hey, look at the maid.